from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, the New York Times has called him the most popular poet in America. Former two-term U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins made a name for himself with poems about falling in love and aging and that reflect the beauty and poignancy of everyday life. His latest collection, Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems, includes work from four of his previously published collections, as well as 50 new poems. He'll join us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. In this hour, we're going to talk with Billy Collins, who was U.S. Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003 and Poet Laureate of the State of New York from 2004 to 2006. He's also a Distinguished Professor of English at City University of New York and has been called America's most popular poet by the New York Times. In fact, speaking of the New York Times, his book hit 15 on the New York Times bestseller list. It comes under fiction. They don't even have a category for poetry. It'll be at the number 17 mark and the seven at number 12 mark on the 17th, which is really something. Also, he's published 10 collections of poetry, and his most recent is a collection of poems from the past decades and 50 new ones called Aimless Love. Joins us for the second Forum Hour. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Nice to be here again.
Well, welcome back. And heavy is the head that is called, you know, the most popular poet in America. That must be a bit of an albatross in some ways, not to bring Coleridge in, but...
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a curse, but I can handle it.
You can live with it.
I mean, someone's got to be the most popular, statistically speaking, so why not me? I'm an only child, so I can take all the attention I get.
But you, not only the attention, I think when you get on the bestseller list of the New York Times and you get called the most popular, must be a lot of damn jealous poets out there.
Well,
Schadenfreude rumbling rampant, I would
But
think.
Michael, isn't that the point of writing anyway, to make other writers jealous? I mean, I thought that's why we all wrote.
I thought you wrote because of love.
Is there any higher motive for it? I didn't know about it if there were.
And here I had come under the impression that you were writing out of love and writing. Well, actually, you do write out of love. In fact, I was reading an interview you did where you said, they asked, who's your audience? That silly question that poets get. And you said, someone I want to fall in love with me.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, a friend of mine was walking around with a friend of his, turned out to be Roger Angel, the New Yorker writer.
Oh, great and, baseball writer.
Yeah. Yeah, and a pedestrian recognized Angel. I don't know how because you never see his picture around. And he stopped him and he praised him. And Angel caught up with my friend and he said to my friend, you know, that's what it's all about. That's what writing is all about. And he said, what's that? He said, the love of strangers. Which is true. I mean, any kind of writing, I think you're trying to engage not someone right around you, but people in the distance.
Don't they say the love of strangers can be dangerous?
Well, all right. We're not talking about one-night stands here.
Well, no. You're in fact, the title poem in this new collection, Aimless Love, talks about love in a vein that people don't know. I mean, seeing a wren, for example, and just walking out and seeing what nature has to offer or what comes across your observational post in life?
Well, it's a poem. I mean, the title poem really is a comparison and contrast between romantic love with all – and it's characterized here as being tempestuous and full of acrimony and bad news sometimes, or at least inconstancy and turmoil. And it's comparing that to the love of everyday things, the love of a flock of geese passing overhead or some wildflowers on the roadside. Just a love that is sort of unrequited, but a love of not just nature, but just sights and sounds around us as we walk through the day.
And that poem is, to me, a splendid example of so much of your poetry. That is, you have the quotidian in your poetry and enjoying the everyday, but you also have a lot of intimacy in your poetry.
Well, I learned that, I think, from Whitman. I mean, it's really all about the whole process of writing is really about influence. And even though Whitman is the broad democratic poet with his arms stretched from the rocky shores of Maine to the sun-drenched shores of California or whatever, he's also a very quiet and intimate poet. And there are poems in which when he says he's kind of hooking his arm around your waist and pointing at something in the distance, you really feel his presence. It's rather chilling. And I want to be very alone with the reader. And that's one reason I don't have a lot of people in my poems. I mean, you'll find my parents in there, and I really couldn't write about them until they died in their 90s. And you'll find a love interest if there's a love poem, but you don't find any relatives or family members, because I feel that the fewer people you have in your poems, the more alone you are with the reader.
And you have a lot of places, though, especially Paris, Istanbul, Palermo, France, just naming a few, Rome.
I've been to most of those places, but my persona has been to some that I haven't, you know. I mean, I have a poem called January in Paris, and I've never been there in January, but I thought it would be better to make it January because it would be less touristy. So I gave my persona a free trip to Paris in January.
Who is the persona? Is that not Billy Collins?
Not exactly. I mean, the persona is it's a vocal set of mannerisms. It's I mean, you might think of it as a character. I mean, when I write, I feel like I'm sort of getting into character. It's not that the persona is kind of an alien creature. He's very close to me, but he's, I would say, a simplification of me and also an improvement on me. He doesn't have a job or any visible means of support. He dawdles around all day and falls into speculations, and he's very interested in the workings of his own mind. And he doesn't seem to take out the garbage or do any of those things. So I want him to be just an immediate viewer of what's around him. I don't want him to be an autobiographical figure that carries all this misery and autobiographical weight into the poem.
Well, that's what the personas used to be. I remember talking to Garrison Keillor about the fact that he said, why do they talk about confessional poetry? He said, you know, I don't even know what that is. And that's, you know, what presumably Ashbery and Plath and Sexton created personas for, to create a sense of using something else to confess, but you don't confess so much. In fact, you're talking about misery, your earlier poetry, when you were a young man, kind of before you found your voice, as they say. You wanted to be Wallace Stevens. I thought, no, you want to be an insurance man? No. You had this sense that you couldn't be funny. You couldn't let loose.
No, and you couldn't. I mean, it was not just my sense. It was true. If you were funny in poetry, before, I know, somewhere around the 60s, you were asked to go to a little room off to the side there, and you had to stay in that room, and the room was called Light Verse. So you'd find in that room people like Ogden Nash, and whom I like very much, and I've written an essay on Nash, in fact.
Very clever.
Yeah, but and the rhyming is incredibly clever. The limitation of Light Verse, as someone pointed out, is that it wants to be funny throughout. It wants to start funny, continue to be funny, and end funny. And I think humor employed in to more serious ends can be used as a more of a device than just a kind of principle of entertainment. In other words, you can swing a poem from the serious into the humorous and vice versa, and thereby create these kind of model these changes, these mood changes in the middle of a poem. But yeah, I didn't think the Romantic poets killed humor. Here's the Romantic.
They killed sex too, didn't they?
They killed sex and they substituted landscape. Yeah, the guys.
But I'm interested in this shift in your life because it was, in many ways, a titanic shift. I mean, I remember reading Adrienne Rich, who said, you know, she was trying to write like Wallace Stevens too, or Frost, or, you know. And then she realized I had to go within. I had to go deeper and deeper within. But you mentioned, I think, poets like Kenneth Koch and Philip Larkin, they kind of open you up. Or I think you also mentioned Carl Shapiro and Howard Nemiroff. In other words, and going across the pond, Ted Hughes, that it wasn't even so much a school of poets or an identification of – it was just particular poets, specific poets, yeah.
I think the doors can open in many directions. So I think it's – I went poet by poet. And I think poets – you can learn stylistic things from poets. You can learn – you can pick up verbal mannerisms. But the other thing another poet can do for you is open one of these doors into, say, humor, or I would say – Sylvia Plath and Sharon Olds both opened this door to a whole new way to think of your parents. I mean, people didn't write about their parents until with such candor until those two poets came along. So it was really getting permission from especially Larkin, Kenneth Koch, some of the California poets. Ron Padgett is another one.
I never heard his name pronounced. It is Koch, huh?
Yeah, it's Koch. Yeah.
I always said Koch in my head. It's a good example of how you need to hear something to pronounce it right.
But these were poets who were who used humor, but it was often irony with an edge, and particularly Larkin, who could be funny in a very disturbing way.
Yeah, talk about writing about your mom and dad. We can't quote that on the air.
That's right. It'd do something to you, though.
I'd like to have you read, if I could press that on you. And, you know, there are a lot of poems I like in this new collection. Some of them, of course, I've read before. Although, before you maybe even select a poem or two to read for us, I was interested in something you said. Somebody asked you another interview I read. As you're working at last for posterity, do you think? And, you know, again, that's one of those ridiculous questions in some ways, but nevertheless, it's the type of questions we interlocutors ask. And you responded by, the only person I think my contemporary that I know is going to last is Merwin, W.S. Merwin. And I'm also a great admirer of Merwin's, but I wonder, what is it in Merwin that you think is so enduring?
Well, I think there's something very pure about Merwin's writing. He's not, he doesn't use any topical references. It's not, you don't think of him as a really contemporary poet. It just seems, I could imagine someone like 50, even 50 years ago and 50 years from now receiving that language in a kind of unfiltered way. I just think there's a kind of lasting quality that he has. And
it's almost like automatic writing or something.
Well, I love the fact that he, as I put it to him once in a Q&A, how he transcended punctuation. And what his answer was very interesting. He said to write without punctuation is really an imposition of form on yourself, because it makes it more difficult if you're going to do it correctly, because you can read a Merwin poem. You're never confused about where the syntactical sense is, and yet there's not one punctuation mark. And that's hard to do. And so it was like writing a sonnet. You have to stick within certain boundaries. So it wasn't like the hell with punctuation. We're poets. It was another constraint.
You have a sonnet here, John Wayland sonnet. I just keep mentioning this name through 14 lines. And it seems to me that you set these kind of tasks for yourself with form. I mean, to write a villanelle, it's no easy task.
Well, I have some formal poems like sonnets and villanelles, and I really enjoy writing haiku, and I stick within the 17-syllable boundary. But even when I'm not writing in received form, I'm always trying to find a form or make up a form for the poem. So early on in a poem, I will, if the poem first utterance of the poem falls into four lines, I'll think, okay, well, we're gonna write quatrains now. Now that might change after I write four or five of them and they're not working and the poem doesn't want to be in that kind of box, and I'll change it. But I'm always seeking some kind of pattern that the poem will cleave to as it goes along.
Is the old cliche true that takeoffs and landings are toughest for poems?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the point of insertion, the first sentence, is really like the kind of DNA of the rest of the poem. It really sets the tone, and I think Ashbery calls it like he said the title is like a key signature. It sets things up. Once the point of insertion is made, then I think if I continue the poem, it definitely has some kind of momentum. And then at some point, you realize I've got to find the ending. You know, it's going along just fine. Then you realize I can't write this. I can't spend the rest of my life writing this poem. I have to find a place where I don't want to say anything and you don't want to hear anything. You know, so we have a mutually agreed point of stoppage.
You read for us?
Sure. Well, here's a poem just based on a common observation. It's called The Chairs That No One Sits In. You see them on porches and on lawns down by the lakeside, usually arranged in pairs, implying a couple who might sit there and look out at the water or the big shade trees. The trouble is, you never see anyone sitting in these forlorn chairs, though at one time it must have seemed a good place to stop and do nothing for a while. Sometimes there is a little table between the chairs where no one is resting a glass or placing a book face down. It may not be any of my business, but let us suppose one day that everyone who placed those vacant chairs on a veranda or a dock sat down in them, if only for the sake of remembering what it was they thought deserved to be viewed from two chairs, side by side, with a table in between. The clouds are high and massive on that day. The woman looks up from her book. The man takes a sip of his drink. Then there is only the sound of their looking, the lapping of lake water, and a call of one bird, then another, cries of joy or warning. It passes the time to wonder which.
Billy Collins, reading from his own work. Is it different for you when you read it than when you hear it in your head or than when it comes to you?
No, I think it's kind of the same. I mean, when I'm writing a poem, I never read it out loud. I never get up on the table and pronounce it. But I'm hearing it in my head. I have I think when any of us reads, we have an acoustic part of our skull that is in which the sounds of the words are resonating.
But that poem even strikes me, as many of your poems do, as a poem, and you were kind of intimating this a bit yourself, that begins and then moves along a trajectory. I mean, you've got chairs, you're putting people in the chairs. You say, I don't put that many people in my poems, but you create the whole scene of the people in the chairs.
Well, here's the problem. I mean, we do see these chairs everywhere, right, on lawns, and rarely do you see anyone sitting in them. And it's, the poem is really a call for kind of a meditative pausing and a silence. And I'm sort of picturing people really using them and just coming to a kind of silence and wondering what that bird call was all about. I mean, it's really a call for meditative moments of peace.
Well, there's a poem that made me think of your own personal trajectory where you're thinking about a Chinese man sitting alone in a restaurant, and the poem takes you to from what you might have done with that Chinese man in the restaurant, perhaps at an earlier incarnation, to
right.
Where the poem leads you. And the poem does seem to lead you. I mean, you know, we don't have a lot of poems here that we could read, Billy. We don't I'm not necessarily. In fact, maybe there's a poem called Envoy, which is right on the back of your book, which is really lovely. And whose decision was it? Was that yours to put it on the back of the book?
No, that was the publisher. It was Random House. They just thought it would be nice just to put a poem on the back instead of cluttering it up with all this kind of gaseous praise from other poets and publications. And it's also I'm a kind of recovering medievalist because I began a course of medieval studies in graduate school, and I came out of a Jesuit college where I was more or less living in the Middle Ages in terms of what we were reading anyway. So
I didn't realize you had such strong Catholic rearing, I mean, in terms of your education, going all the way back to childhood.
Well, yeah, I had the full metal jacket, 16 years of quality Catholic education. When I got to graduate school in Southern California, it was the first time I'd been in a classroom with a female since the eighth grade, so that was quite shocking.
And there is a poem in this collection called Catholicism, but what, are you going to read something for us again?
Well, I'll read the little poem called Envoy, which is, it's part of this medieval tradition where at the end of a long poem, Chaucer does this in Troilus and Cressida, he kisses his book goodbye. He bids his book farewell and sends it out into the world. Envoy. Go, little book, out of this house and into the world. Carriage made of paper rolling toward town, bearing a single passenger beyond the reach of this jittery pen and far from the desk and the nosy gooseneck lamp. It is time to decamp, put on a jacket, and venture outside. Time to be regarded by other eyes, bound to be held in foreign hands. So off you go, infants of the brain, with a wave and some bits of fatherly advice. Stay out as late as you like. Don't bother to call or write, and talk to as many strangers as you can.
Right back to strangers again.
Yeah, right. Get out there and talk to the strangers.
The poem that I was referencing is an old man eating alone in a Chinese restaurant. It's on 121.
Uh-huh.
You want to read that?
Okay. Yeah, this is sort of a poem about time catching up with you. Old man eating alone in a Chinese restaurant. I am glad I resisted the temptation, if it was a temptation when I was young, to write a poem about an old man eating alone at a corner table in a Chinese restaurant. I would have gotten it all wrong, thinking, the poor bastard, not a friend in the world, and with only a book for a companion, he'll probably pay the bill out of a change purse. So glad I waited all these decades to record how hot and sour the hot and sour soup is here at Chang's this afternoon, and how cold the Chinese beer in a frosted glass, and my book, Jose Saramago's Blindness, as it turns out, is so absorbing that I look up from its escalating horrors only when I am stunned by one of its arresting sentences. And I should mention the light, which falls through the big windows this time of day, italicizing everything it touches, the plates and teapots, the immaculate tablecloths, as well as the soft brown hair of the waitress in the white blouse and the short black skirt, the one who is smiling now as she bears a cup of rice and shredded beef with garlic to my favorite table in the corner.
This is it's not sour at all. It's very sweet, is what it is.
Yeah. Okay.
I like it. Some of these playful poems are really particularly delightful and accessible to, I'm thinking about one called Hippos on Holiday, and I mean, accessible to kids. I just want to talk with you a bit about that. I mean, because you did a lot of work, like Bob Haas and other poet laureates, really trying to reach children and make them excited about poetry. A lot of poetry is obscure. A lot of poetry is difficult, inaccessible, too symbolic or abstract for young people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think young people are all naturally appreciators of poetry and little poets themselves in some cases. I've judged poetry contests for young people and in different categories usually. And when they're young, in, say, middle school, they're delightful. You know, they're like little surrealists. Their imaginations are crazy. They're unfettered and they're jumping all over the place with wild comparisons. And they love the play of it. They love the game of it and the imaginative freedom of it.
What would you have them read, though? I mean, depending on the age group, of course. But, you know, when kids are at the age where they might really be initiated into desiring to read more poetry.
Well, I have I mean, my theory is that poetry should be taught chronologically backwards. So I think it's best. I mean, children at the age I was just describing, really, you don't have to do anything with them. You know, they're just fine on their own. You can read Mother – you can start with Mother Goose or go anywhere, and they love rhyming games and all that. What happens is that adolescence comes along, and most of them go into a kind of tunnel where they're self-conscious, they're uncertain, they're putting on attitudes. Well, I don't have to explain adolescence to the audience or to you.
I fall upon the thorns of life, I bleed.
Yeah, well, stuff like that. They're falling upon the thorns of their life, you know, in their rooms there and bleeding. And the poetry suffers. The poetry becomes cliched and dull and unimaginative and self-pitying. And
let me bring our listeners into this opportunity for you to talk with Billy Collins. We welcome your involvement in the program or to talk about poetry with us in general. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program. Call us, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Billy Collins. The New York Times did indeed call him the most popular poet in America. He's now on their bestseller list under fiction, because they don't have a category for poetry. Former two-term U.S. poet laureate, made a name for himself with poems about falling in love and aging, and that reflect the beauty and poignancy of everyday life. And his latest collection is called Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems, and it includes work from four of his previously published collections, as well as 50 new poems. And you are welcome to join us if you have questions or comments for Billy Collins. And I always like, whenever we talk about poetry or talk to poets, to find out what poetry some of you have either been excited by or galvanized by or ignited by in your life, single poems or poets. It's always edifying I shouldn't use that word. It's always illuminating to hear what listeners have to say along those lines. And you can, again, join our program toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or actually post any questions or comments you have on our website. Our email, I think, is not working. So website's kqed.org/forum. That's kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, at @KQEDForum. A number of ways, obviously, to communicate with us. Billy Collins also holds the title Distinguished Professor of English at Lehman College in the Bronx and is a senior fellow of the Winter Park Institute of Rollins College. And let me give a few plugs here. He'll be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at Dominican University in San Rafael, an event which is being sponsored by Book Passage of Corte Madeira. And on Saturday, November 9th at 7, he'll be at Kepler's in Menlo Park. But meantime, he's with us. Let me go to your calls here, and let's begin with a caller from Sacramento, Cassandra. That's a great name to have beginning here. Go ahead.
Well, hi. I am just such a major fan, and I have all of your books, and I love listening to you recite your poetry. So when I read your poems, I think of your voice reciting them. I would like to recommend that you put all of your poems on a CD.
Well, we've done that to some extent. I have a CD that was done some years ago called Billy Collins Live at Symphony Space. But this new book, Aimless Love, we have a CD that goes with that. I don't read the whole book, but the CD is called Aimless Love. It's a Random House audio, and you can get it at Amazon or fine bookstores near you.
Cassandra, I have a quick question. Just wonder what it's like to go through life with the name Cassandra. Do people ask you to prophesy, or they say, is the world coming to an end, or anything?
The prophecy of doom. I'm a former human resources person, doomed to be never believed.
Well, thank you for calling, and it's good to hear from you this morning. Let's hear from another caller, and that's Mac joining us. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wanting to ask Billy what he thinks of the idea of people reading poems to strangers as they walk by on the sidewalk uninvited, which is a hobby of mine, actually, that I've been doing for a number of years, and was inspired by the anthology Poetry 180, which Billy Collins edited. I know that he reads to strangers all the time, but usually they go specifically to hear him. Would he endorse surprising people with uninvited poetry?
Well, the word importuning comes to mind. I hope your poems are short.
I don't read my own poems. I read yours often.
Oh, well, in that case, great. Yeah, please continue that. And in fact, you should be out there now. Why are you wasting time calling us? Get out there and read some Billy Collins poems.
Yeah, I remember a number of years ago during my misspent youth being in Las Vegas, and somebody came up and said, I'll read a poem to you for 50 cents. And I was curious what this poem was going
to
be.
I'll give you $1 to read the poem.
Well, of course, it was his poem. That was the problem. I was thinking, you know, it might have been Whitman or something. But let me get another caller on here. And Sharon, that's you. Good morning.
Oh, hello. Yes. One of my favorite poets is Theodore Ruthke. I would just love to hear any impressions Billy Collins has about this poet from the past. Just a bit about, I don't know, what he's all about or his style or anything about him, if he ever researched or knew him. And then second question would be, if there was such a thing as a poetry van that traveled around and stopped at parks and schools to just be like, not exactly a bookmobile, but just, hey, this is poetry. Come take a book, listen to something being read, get exposed. How would he envision that poetry van to be?
Well, as for Ruthke, I'm a great great fan of his poetry.
It makes two of us, by the way.
And he has a number of poems. I mean, the way poets are preserved these days and the way their reputation to the general public is determined, unfortunately, I suppose, is whether they get into the big anthologies like the Norton Anthology. And so there's two or three poems of Ruthke's that are part of everyone's classroom experience.
Just to see if we have the same taste here or had the same classroom experience, My Papa's Waltz.
My Papa's Waltz.
That's got to be one. And the other one that immediately comes to mind is that poem he wrote about a student.
Elegy for Jane.
Yeah. So we're on the same page.
Yeah, those are the two. Well, we've got the same anthology.
They're wonderful poems.
The anecdote I remember, I never met Ruthke, but the anecdote I remember about him, he was a rather big man, and he He said that when he was stuck in a, not stuck in a poem, but if he was writing and he felt he was becoming overblown or pretentious or, you know, just losing the right tone, he would take off all his clothes and stand in front of a full-length mirror and just say, "Who are you kidding?" It would bring him up. Anyway, I like the idea of the van very much. I'm all for poetry in public places. I think, are you able to drive a van?
Well, I just envision it. I haven't created it, but I'm sure anybody could learn to drive a van. I'm just curious,
I think,
if you had a comment of how would you envision it? What should it be? And also, my favorite Rutsky poem is The Waking.
Oh, yeah. Very
it's
good
also
as well.
A terrific poem, yeah.
Well, I think it should just say, I think you should be the driver, and I think it should just say the poetry van on the side, and just do exactly what it does, like a poetry bookmobile. You know, when the Poetry Foundation received $150 million or something from Ruth Lilly, I thought not of a poetry van, but I thought of something a little grander, to have a poetry yacht, you know, like the size of an Onassis Greek 150-foot, it would be the poetry boat, and that would go around the world spreading the word of poetry, and I would be on board.
You know that William Carlos Williams poem, The Yachts?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And right. In fact, sometimes you remind me of Williams. I mean, in terms of the near at hand, especially earlier Williams, that's later.
Yeah. Well, we do. We both use a simple vocabulary anyway. I'm not trying to pare things down completely as he did, but I did write a version of one of his most famous poems. I think I can say it. It's called The Widower. This is just to say, I have eaten the plums this morning that I was saving for breakfast.
I know that poem, and sometimes your work does remind me of that poem or makes me think of that poem, which some people say is just really a note on a refrigerator.
That's a sad version of it. Well, you know, students, when you read that poem to them, they say, you know, so what, or the chickens and the red wheelbarrow. And then the way to get them to appreciate William Carlos Williams is to make them read The Wasteland. And then they think, then they say, can we get back to, you know, reading the one about the wheelbarrow? That was a good poem.
Reminds me of an old Woody Allen line. You know, the you're talking about how poetry is judged. He said, the better poetry is evaluated on how obscure and incomprehensible it is. You know, he was riffing on Yeats and some of the difficulty of getting in that vortex that Yeats provides for us. I mean, it can sometimes seem, like I said, to be extremely recondite.
Well, I think every art has an experimental outside limit to it, where good work is being done. John Cage said there's no such thing as experimental art. They're just work that's necessary to be done. And so I think there are poems that are necessarily difficult. Poetry really begins to speak after the limits of prose have been reached. So it's able to say very difficult things in difficult ways. But there's also difficulty for its own sake, where poets are just using the language as camouflage, and I just have no interest in finding them in the bushes there.
Well, a lot of your poems are about poetry. In fact, you write about Marianne Moore, and I'm always reminded of that poem, I Too Dislike It. You know, it's a poem called Poetry. You know?
Yeah.
There's also a poem in your collection called The Great American Poem, which now normally, again, maybe it's because you're getting in the fiction category of bestsellers, but people think of that going with novel, not with poem.
Well, it's a, you know, the poem is a compare. I'm always comparing poetry to prose, favorably, I hope. Kenneth Koch, in fact, gave a great example. I think he said, here's an example of prose and then poetry. So prose would be no dogs allowed on the beach. Okay. Poetry would be no dogs or logs allowed on the beach, no poodle, however trim, no dachshund unable to swim. Now, the difference there, I think, is that the language, the words in the second one are enjoying each other's company. They like being in that field of sound and irony. And I think that's what happens in poetry. Instead of prose, where the novel, where you just have this linear run, one damn thing after another, in poetry you have a field that is displacing silence. And in that field, the words are really all kind of interacting with each other. Kay Ryan is a great example of creating little fields of verbal activity where all the words are happy to be with each other.
Our local now U.S. Laureate poet again, succeeding. We've had a lot that have come out of this area. You're one of the few Easterners, in fact. Even Pinsky spent some time here. Well, let me get to some more calls. A lot of people want to talk to you. And let me go next to Santa Rosa. And welcome, Jennifer. You're on. Hi. Jennifer?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air. Well, I don't know where she went. Let me go to another caller.
Jennifer.
Lori is on. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to thank you for having this lovely poet on with his extremely musical voice. I do also, like another caller said, hear your voice, read your poems. And I wanted to share some poets that I came to know in a poetry class I took at Pico State years ago with Gary Thompson, who introduced us to then new poets. I think Marvin Bell, Gary Snyder, and Mark Strand at that time. And just wanted to know if you knew them and what you thought of them and just share those names. And thank you for your good writing.
Well, those are three poets that belong on the baseball team. I know Mark Strand a little. He's the only one I really know. And he's a powerful poet.
What position do you play on that team?
I'm right field. Out there praying the ball is not hit to me. Gary Snyder, you know, really a pioneer in American ecological writing and nature writing.
And also importing Japanese and Zen ideas.
Yeah, a very, very crucial player in his time, and he's still...
started out as a beat poet, in fact.
Yes, he did. And I think one of the few poets who survived that and who whose poetry continued beyond that phase. So Marvin Bell, I really don't know his work as well as I should.
Speaking of that phase, are you a fan of Baraka's?
His name rings a bell, but...
I mean, because Leroy Jones, I mean, he started out as Leroy Jones and was a kind of bohemian beat poet and then...
Well, there was a great deal of violence in his, his plays too. The
Dutchman. Yeah.
The Dutchman and the Toilet. I mean, there was a lot of... A lot of anger there, and I think he's still an angry poet. Not that that's a bad thing. I mean, I'm surprised more Americans aren't vocally angry about lots of things that are going on in this country these days. Why aren't we in the streets? Oh, we're pretty calm people.
We wouldn't be in the streets reading poems to strangers like that caller we had earlier. Here's a listener who tweets, I teach poetry to middle school kids in Sonoma County. I love to teach Collins' poem, The Lanyard. What was the inspiration for that poem?
Well, the first stanza of that poem explains the inspiration. I was literally leafing through a dictionary, and at the top of the page, they have those words in bold type. I think they're called headers, maybe, but they tell you the first and last words on the page. And there was the word lanyard, and it just set off this Proustian memory charge. I just thought of being at camp. I thought of my mother, and I felt that that had some momentum, so I just started the poem by describing the circumstances of its beginning, and then I got into this kind of ironic contrast of one's mother giving one life and sustenance and education and getting in return this useless, crummy looking little lanyard.
Interesting question. A listener wants to know, does Mr. Collins think about memorizing poetry?
Well, I think I make my students memorize poetry. I mean, my sense is that they might forget everything I've told them, but if they can recite an Emily Dickinson poem before they leave, they might have that for life. And I was spotted on a subway by a former student some years ago. I had him in class maybe 15 years ago. He'd become a doctor, an oncologist, in fact. But he recognized me, and he came over, and we were talking a little bit, and he said, you made me memorize a poem. And there on the subway, on the 4 train in New York, he recited a little Emily Dickinson poem, and I thought that was a great accomplishment.
Yeah, I think the first line I had to remember, oh, to be in England now that April's there, and whoever wakes in England finds some morning unaware. That was Mrs. Agnes Regan, about 10th grade English.
Still in there.
Still in my cerebellum, which is, of course, atrophying by the day here. But there's a poem, actually, speaking about, you write a poem about the Cleveland suburbs, and a 17-year-old girl who remains unidentified. That I assume maybe, I don't know, child, grandchild,
well,
niece, or just somebody of your imagination.
Well, let's say a future stepdaughter, potential stepdaughter.
It's an important poem. I mean, in terms of kind of putting yourself in the adolescent mind that you were talking about before.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a frustrated. I'm kind of role playing there. It's a frustrated parent who is, you know, got a 17 typical 17 year old, American teenager, and he is comparing her to all these historic figures who have composed symphonies and led the French army to victory, and compared to her. Sitting around the house and staring into space, but
it's also an attempt to kind of wake her up, too, isn't it?
In a way, yeah. I think that would backfire.
At that age, yeah.
Yeah.
Also, early on, I mean, the poetry moves chronologically through your rather stellar career, and we're early on in a poem. You were mentioning Emily Dickinson before. Maybe you could read this if you – I like it. It reminds me of Because I Could Not Stop for Death, and I don't know if that was even an influence, but it's called Writing in the Afterlife, and it's on page 36.
Well, it's about teaching writing, really, which I've done for too long, I think. Writing in the Afterlife. I imagine the atmosphere would be clear, shot with pristine light, not this sulfurous haze. The air ionized as before a thunderstorm. Many have pictured a river here, but no one mentioned all the boats, their benches crowded with naked passengers, each bent over a writing tablet. I knew I would not always be a child with a model train and a model tunnel, and I knew I would not live forever, jumping all day through the hoop of myself. I had heard about the journey to the other side and the clink of the final coin in the leather purse of the man holding the oar, but how could anyone have guessed that as soon as we arrived, we would be asked to describe this place and to include as much detail as possible? Not just the water, he insists, rather the oily, fathomless, rat-happy water. Not simply the shackles, but the rusty, iron, ankle-shredding shackles, and that our next assignment would be to jot down off the tops of our heads, our thoughts and feelings about being dead. Not really an assignment, the man rotating the oar keeps telling us. Think of it more as an exercise, he groans. Think of writing as a process, a never-ending, infernal process. And now the boats have become jammed together, bow against stern, stern locked to bow, and not a thing is moving. Only our diligent pens.
I like that. Why it reminded me of Dickinson, though? I mean, you know, it's sort of like moving into the next sphere and the next orbit, although I get the writing part of it.
The thing I love about Dickinson is this very polite language, you know, in the little bouncy rhythms that she's doing in this common meter. And it's all very, there's this kind of etiquette about it and courtesy. And yet she is sinking into the darkest types of subjects. I mean, she's like in the grave and talking about losing your mind and losing your life. And it's a beautiful tension between that kind of civility and the kind of horror of some of her topics.
Yeah, I was with Brenda Hellman and Bob Haas recently, and she sent me a little Dickinson collection, a very small miniature collection. And I remembered a friend of mine named Maurice Bastin, in fact, who lives in San Francisco for many, many years and taught English at San Francisco State, who used to say, read Emily Dickinson, it's all you need to know. Yeah. Like Keats ends his poem, you know, all you need to know on earth or something like that. John asks, does Billy Collins ever tweet, and how does he feel about the 140 characters format? Is it a limit or a concentrated focus for quips?
No, I haven't tweeted. I've done a lot of terrible things in my life, but I haven't tweeted yet anyway. I'm struck by the fact that I don't know why it's 140 characters, but I do know why there's 140 syllables in a Shakespearean sonnet. Right? It's 14 lines, and it's iambic pentameter, so that's 10 beats a line. So a Shakespearean sonnet is exactly 140 syllables. And I don't know if the guy who came up with Twitter was referring to that, but it's an odd parallel.
It might have been literate that way. One never knows. Laura writes, I adore you. And it goes on.
Good start.
Then the next line is, what poem would you want read at your funeral?
Oh, you know, I don't know, but there's a great poem by Lawrence Robb, and I forget the name of it, but it's about the vanity of thinking what you want, the music you want played at your funeral. And he starts out as a young man, he wanted Jumpin' Jack Flash. And then he got sentimental. He turned into a brooding romantic genius, and he wanted Adagio for his strings with Barber. And I think at the end he decides on an Oscar Peterson solo or something like that. But so
You want a whole medley maybe.
Yeah, right.
Here's another tweet. Jim says, Collins' poems are great, but it's his insights about poetry, the way he discusses words, language I love best. And Stephanie on our website says, when I was a kid in school, we had to memorize and recite a poem, a form of torture? Or does it give kids and grown-ups a personal connection to poetry and a lifelong appreciation? Or is there no connection whatsoever?
I think there's a great resistance. I mean, whenever I announce that to a class that a requirement of the class is to memorize a poem, there is a universal groan that goes out. But once they memorize the poem, once they internalize it, they feel a great thrill of possession, and then they can't wait to come in to my office and deliver it and recite it. They're very proud of themselves, and it does have, as you demonstrate, Michael, it does have a lasting effect. My mother memorized poems as a child in Canada, and in her 80s and 90s, she could still come up with lines from Shakespeare. So the embeddedness of poem is just an intimate. You can't memorize a painting or a building, you know, but you can memorize a poem and carry it inside you.
Listener asks, I want to know if Mr. Collins feels guilty if he writes a poem too quickly. That's something I always wonder.
No, I'm grateful that I can, you know, get out of the poem and get on with the rest of my life. You know, sometimes a quick poem it really works because it's presumably backed up with decades of thinking and practice, and occasionally a poem does fall in your lap.
You normally you do a lot of revising.
I do tons of four or five, six drafts of the poem, one right after the other, but all in the same sitting. It's all in a morning or an afternoon.
Can Billy Collins comment on doing the Writer's Almanac heard on NPR stations? He came across rather somber, speaking slowly and dirge-like, whereas on this show this morning he has lilt in his voice and a wink in his eye. Comment on mood, please. I try to fight my tendency toward melancholy, and I prefer to read poetry that makes me chuckle or laugh out loud. It is so therapeutic.
Well, it was sort of an honor in a way to be asked to fill in for Garrison Keillor on the Writer's Almanac last summer. But you're right. You detected a seriousness that I was a little intimidated. I mean, Garrison Keillor had been doing the show for 17 years. Everyone connects the show intimately and unmistakably with his voice. And here's this new kid that's coming in. I felt like I was doing a bad cover of someone else's song. I think by August, I kind of got a little lighter and was able to adapt it. But I did get to choose the poem, so that was fun.
Billy Collins, so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
And it's Thursday, and that means it's time again for our listener mailbag segment. And to start off, reactions to our show with Andrew Solomon, who joined us to discuss his book, Far From the Tree, which examines lives of parents with children who are different, kids with conditions like deafness or autism, for example. Anna Rada wrote, your guest did a disservice by expressing an implicit bias early in the hour when he stated that, quote, no one tries to cure you of your ethnicity. If only this were true, any person of color who has tried to move beyond social expectations of his or her kind experiences, a similar identity disconnect to what Solomon describes. Society enforces white expectations and standards uniformly, and families express feelings of betrayal and mistrust. Those families also need the advice in this book. And Darrow wrote, my son has attended a San Francisco school for 8 years in a class that has included a child with emotional disabilities, a type of autism. His parents had to go to great lengths to have their son included in mainstream classes rather than special ed. My son has benefited greatly by having this child in his classes all these years, and he has learned that being different includes both difficult and outstanding qualities. And I think that having this child in our school has been a fabulous experience for all of our kids and families. Last week, Erica Jong joined us to discuss the 40th anniversary of her novel Fear of Flying, and a question came in at the very end of the show that we were not able to read on air, but Ms. Jong indulged us by sharing her answer after the show. Daryl asks, can Erica Jong recommend some profound fiction as well as nonfiction for a father that wants his daughters to grow up independent thinkers? I have three daughters, 18 to 32, and Erica Jong's recommendation, The Golden Notebook by Doris Lessing. And lastly, during our show with David Finkel about what soldiers face when they come back from war, several listeners asked how they could help veterans. Here are some suggestions that came into us. Anne wrote, help veterans with pro bono legal and accounting work. My uncle, a veteran, volunteers at the VA to help veterans fill out forms and successfully navigate the system to get the services they need. It's unglamorous, but that aspect of civilian life is soul-deadening and difficult for everyone, and a terrible thing to put between our military personnel and the services they need. And Beth says, as a marriage and family therapy intern, I call upon Bay Area therapists to consider accepting one or two returning soldier families for pro bono work. I work with couples and have seen from how the war experience introduces challenges for even healthy couples and puts unreasonable strains on couples struggling already. This forum program has encouraged me to seek out a way to offer pro bono work for at least a couple hours a week, and I hope other therapists will match the effort. Thank you for our listeners and for all the great suggestions and questions, and you can listen to our past shows online at forum@kqed.org, or you can always email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. And I always remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or our Facebook page. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and our interns, Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valle, Angela Johnson, and Aaron Newport. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, your public radio station, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.